Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. 40 years ago, the head of the Gannett newspaper chain launched what many jokingly referred to at the time as the McPaper. USA Today, the national paper known for its use of infographics, color, and the brevity of its stories, went on to reach a circulation of more than 2 million by the 1990s. Now, a lot has changed about the newspaper business since then, and USA Today has shared in some of that change, but it's still around, unlike scores of local newspapers across the country. Rick Edmonds is a media business analyst for the Poynter Institute and recently wrote about USA Today. We'll post a link to his column at WOSU.org/All Sides. Rick Edmonds, welcome back to All Sides.
Good to be with you again, Ann.
I remember when it came out, I was traveling a lot, and it was in every hotel room, you know, outside every hotel room in the morning, right? That was part of its big strategy. At the time, Al Newhouse, the flamboyant late publisher of USA Today, said it was, quote, created to be unapologetically different, intentionally accessible in its mission to serve everyday Americans. Did it achieve that goal?
Well, I think it largely did in its early days. As I've written more than once, I think the model is threatened now, and in a similar but a little bit different way from what's challenging American newspapers generally. I mean, of course, we have just been in a period where people rarely traveled, so that main distribution channel to the hotels has been cut down. And I think there's a, you know, basic change also affects magazines greatly, which is in the old times you would read USA Today with your breakfast, or if you're getting on a plane, long flight, you'd buy four different magazines. The electronic options have certainly eaten into that. So I think that the and I've written this again before, the paper version is going to be difficult to sustain over time. It's lasted longer than I thought it might. Conversely, I think USA Today as an electronic product and as a network that draws on the 200 plus regional papers that Gannett owns is pretty strong. That's maybe a longer answer than you wanted.
No, not a bit. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. It's the 40th birthday of USA Today, and I'm talking with media business analyst for the Poynter Institute, Rick Edmonds, about that. What were your impressions, listeners out there, when USA Today hit the floor in front of your hotel room, I guess? For most of us, that's where we saw it. Give us a call, 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. You know, coming up through the newspaper business myself, that was what my goal was in life, and I thought it was sort of, I don't know, a cheapened version of the paper. But what's interesting to me 40 years later is how the newspaper industry embraced some really basic things that we take for granted today, and infographics is one of them. They talk about the strategy for that and how that sort of, you know, was a game changer.
Well, I think the cornerstone of that was the weather map, and a gentleman named George Schwiers, who was kind of the inventor of that, later taught at Poynter, where I work. And, you know, that I think anybody who looked at that in the newspaper business said, boy, that is a whole lot better than what we present for weather with, you know, a few little boxes and so forth. So there was that. But they went for a variety of charts, graphics, et cetera, to tell the story. And if you look at very sophisticated papers like the New York Times, that's one of many storytelling tools that have probably been generally adapted. So yes, there was that influence. Also, the use of color, including using sort of color tabs to identify the different sections of the paper, that really caught on. They said in their press release that they invented that. That's not really true. My other employers, the Tampa Bay Times, had fabulous color in the 80s, and quite a few other papers that started on that, especially in Europe. But they definitely were so influential that a lot of other papers said, you know, we need to get with this to keep up.
Could any other company have done the same thing at the time? Because you made the point that it tapped into its local papers to provide a lot of the copy.
Yeah, actually, that was something of a sidelight that when USA Today started, even within the company, and it was Mr. Newhart's pet project, it didn't have very much staff. So it literally drew upon some of their largest papers. Rochester, Wilmington, Delaware, et cetera, were sort of taxed with, you know, how many papers can you, reporters can you spare to get this started? But yeah, I think it was, it would have been hard for other chains. I'm trying to think, you know, Knight Ridder was a big and prosperous chain then. Possibly they could have started it, but as you suggested at first, it was to some extent a vision of Mr. Newhart's, and he was, besides being flamboyant, he was a very original thinker about news and about newspapers.
You know, there's the Ohio the USA Today Network News Ohio Bureau,
right?
Now, right? And I'm sure I assume they have them in other states.
Yeah, we have about 15 or 18 papers in Florida that are owned by Gannett. So it provides, you know, a large network for covering the state, and they can do statewide projects. And that's not true in every state, but Ohio and Florida and some others are good examples.
I think it's interesting that they identify with the USA Today brand when they've started to create these bureaus around the country.
Well, yes, and I think the naming of the USA Today Network, which I don't know, I want to say took place somewhere between 5 and 10 years ago, reflects that, and it's a good brand. It says something more to more people than it would be to call it the Gannett National Network, which sort of is equally descriptive of it. And the column you mentioned, I spoke with Maribel Wadsworth, who has a very high position, has been sort of the main person with USA Today for a long time. And she made kind of an interesting point I hadn't thought of, that even if you aren't going to hotels all the time, and even at the hotels, they don't put it in at your door anymore.
Right.
People associate that with some very positive experiences. I mean, most of us enjoy business travel on the whole. Yeah, it could be kind of a pain sometimes, but that's part of the whole equation, was the presence of USA Today. So it's a brand with some very positive associations.
At the time of its debut, more than 20 metro newspapers had merged or gone belly up in the months leading up to the launch. How risky of a venture was it at the time?
Oh, I think it was quite risky. And like a lot of startups of that era, it took a long time. Gosh, I want to say maybe 10 or 15 years for it to actually make money. So it was, it needed the blessing of the chief executive, which it had. And I don't think they expected it to be, you know, instantaneously a moneymaker, but, you know, very expensive to set up distribution printing all over the country, and to strike the deals with the hotels, and to build a base of other subscribers. So, and an advertising base. All that took a while.
You know, critics at the time called it junk food journalism. You know, and I remember reading it, you know, after going to a school of journalism, and my only complaint was, frankly, that the stories were too short. You know, they kind of would grab you, and you'd flip the paper over, and you're like, oh my God, that's it. That's all they're putting in there.
Yeah, I think if you do look at the print paper now, and I did that, I mean, don't see it every day, but I did that in preparation for this story. The stories have gotten a good deal longer. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think they actually, Ms. Wadsworth said, yeah, you want to get a little of that zip of the very short stories back into it. But like other papers, they kind of pick their shots, and if they're going to do a story, I mean, not like a gigantic magazine story, but they have some length and some heft to it now. But yeah, I think in the early days, it struck many people, especially people in our business, as overly short, you know, sort of choppy and a kind of a a mannered way of presenting the news. It was always it's always USA, USA everywhere, and it's kind of, you know, stories like we are eating more breakfast cereal. That kind of voice seemed a little strange. I think from the start that it's sports coverage, it's lifestyle coverage, and particularly it's coverage of travel and nuts and bolts of getting around, which is a national match, was pretty good. It took quite a while for the straight news side to catch up with that. And I think their reputation for being, you know, sort of bland, frivolous, et cetera, sort of dogged them well past the point where that was really an accurate characterization of what they did.
You know, the other section where they do a paragraph from each state. Now, right. even as I say the stuff was too short, that's the first section I would go to, right? You'd go and see what was happening in your state.
Sure. Yeah, where you live and where you used to live and a few other things. And that's, as they've changed a number of things, they've kept that, it's maybe a little shorter than it used to be, but they've kept that page.
Why do you think that's endured?
Well, I think for the reasons we're just saying, it's for the traveler, it's a chance to get at least a little snapshot of your home, and the stories are varied. They're very short and telegraphic, but you know, I think the digital age and the way people consume news, awful lot of it is headline and first sentence or paragraph, and you know, you say okay, that's that'll be enough. I'll move on to something else. So I think they were onto something about the viability of very, very short news stories.
How is it done in the digital era? As far as its digital presence goes, is it complementary? It seems like it would make a lot of sense.
Well, that's an excellent question, and I think that's among the challenges it faces. So they've certainly had a main website, news website, for a long time. They've invested in that. They've had sort of specialized sites in sports and some other areas. But for a very long time, until about a year and a half ago, their strategy was to keep the website free. And that was out of step with the way even their own newspapers were going, beginning to build paid digital subscriptions. So I think it was sort of a shock to the system in a business sense when they began going to a paywall of sorts. The way their paywall works is that part of the news is free, but sort of heavier stories, so-called premium stories, you can only access those if you're a subscriber.
Is USA Today making money?
Ms. Bosworth said so.
Right. I saw that.
I think a little bit depends how you count up the score, and even though public companies do need to disclose their results, sort of how they make those calculations, what's charged to USA, what's charged elsewhere, is a little tricky. But I think, and you know, we may get into this in this segment or later on, but Gannett is having a very difficult year, and a number of things sort of broke wrong for them. So overall, the company is not making money, and actually doesn't expect to make money for maybe another year or two as they work through this digital transition. So I kind of think USA Today is part of that equation.
That is Rick Edmonds. He's a media business analyst for the Poynter Institute in Florida. He wrote about USA Today's 40th birthday in his opinion column. We'll have a link to that on our website at WOSU.org/allsides. We will continue our conversation, and we also are interested in talking about local news this hour. Listeners, if you remember USA Today back in the day, tell us what you thought. Tell us what you think now. 614-292-8513 or email us at allsides@wosu.org. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Thank you. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Dan Fisher. We're looking at the impact USA Today has had on newspapers and the future of daily newspapers in today's changing media landscape. Many newspapers have reduced the number of days they print or switched online to online-only content. Traffic to local news websites has declined. It's a mess out there. My guest is Rick Edmonds. He's a media business analyst for the Poynter Institute, and he recently wished the nation's newspaper, USA Today, a happy 40th birthday. You can check that out at WOSU.org/allsides. You know, in addition to, we often look at USA Today and think just about the design. Is there any other thing that USA Today brought about when it comes to change in other newspapers?
You know, I think it is in some ways one of a kind. It certainly competed and does directly with the New York Times, Wall Street Journal, and Washington Post, to the extent that's become pretty much of a national paper as in its digital format. But I don't know that it really exactly as a model for a regional paper. As I mentioned earlier, I mean, I think their use of their regional newspaper group to help with the stories in USA Today, for instance, covering last week's hurricane is sort of significant. And they also do it the opposite way, that they originate investigations at the national newspaper and then can kind of localize them. But, you know, that's more or less unique to Gannett.
Another legacy of the late publisher Al Newhart was an emphasis on diversity in the industry. Right. And that's certainly been really obvious in Ohio as they continue to buy up papers. They're putting women and minorities in front and center.
Yeah, I think there are some things to criticize about Gannett, and I'm among those who are critics, but not that. They were early and sincerely committed to diversity. I think I may have mentioned that they, back in the time I was starting to cover this, the late 90s and early 2000s, executives' bonuses were partly pegged to whether they'd made some progress on diversity, and that may have slid some in recent years, but they've come back more strongly on it. And it's at a time when, I mean, I think there's a sort of a general awakening to that in the industry and action at other individual newspapers and chains. But what used to be a pretty effective measure by the National Association of Editors, the ASNE, to do a census to see how many minorities were in each newsroom and for papers to voluntarily sort of do a tally of where they were, that just has kind of fallen by the wayside.
Why? So,
it's partly because it was complicated to compile. There's a question about whether other kinds of diversities, you know, sexual orientation and so forth ought to be considered too. Mm-hmm. But I think it suggested that papers that weren't doing too well didn't really want to sort of take the pledge and be part of that program.
Page views used to be the metrics that newspapers used to measure traffic to the websites, but they've fallen out of favor. What's going on there?
They've fallen out of favor and they've fallen. So kind of got two things going on at once there. Okay. Yeah, I think the view from people who are producing the news for some time has been that, you know, that's not necessarily the best measure. And you pick up a lot of what's sometimes called drive-by traffic. People just sort of stumble on a story. They may look at it for a minute or two. That's particularly true of the measure of unique visitors. What you're really looking for is some other things like time spent with stories or time spent on the page, time, how many times somebody, you know, stays and goes to other stories. And then in particular, what's coming to be most important is whether the experience with the digital site causes people to subscribe, causes people to at least register and get a little bit of more access to the site. So one of the experts, a couple of the experts I've talked to say, it's unfortunate the page views have declined, but that's not the most important thing if you're having some success in building paid subscriptions, which is sort of the main business focus of most newspapers now, is to make a transition to digital and to have the users pay more of what advertisers used to pay.
Okay, but I mean, subscriptions, went in the print, in the olden days, that right. was what they bandied about to advertisers.
Right, yeah.
Is that still the case, or?
I mean, yes and no. Okay. The and that's part of what we're talking about USA Today earlier, their digital strategy was to get as many viewers and paid views and uniques and say, we're covering the nation like no one else by ads here. That wasn't as good a strategy locally, and some papers that pursued it and kind of got heavily into digital before readers were ready to make that transition kind of got punished for that in the marketplace, New Orleans being the most conspicuous example. That their circulation fell off and others came in. I think that and maybe I should have completed that thought before, that page views and uniques may in the end not be the best measure, but that's still sort of the default measure by some advertisers. And quite a lot of advertising is not sold by a human being anymore. It's so-called programmatic. You sort of fill out the blanks and buy some space, and that is priced according to page views and uniques. So it still has an influence.
What do we know about the decline in traffic to news websites? Why that's happening?
Yeah, I think there are two common explanations. I mean, I don't think anybody knows for sure, but to some extent, it varies with the algorithms and so forth of the big platform companies. An awful lot of the news traffic comes from there, as you know, but I don't think everybody does. The numbers of people who go directly to the site of the Columbus Dispatch or the Tampa Bay Times, that's not the majority by a long shot of the traffic. So it's coming from these other places. And as they change the rules or change their own emphasis, Facebook Meta has said, and I think it's right, they're de-emphasizing news as an offering. That can affect page views. I think the most people say the more significant part is some falling interest in news generally, and that does spill over into local and the Trump era nationally, and the COVID epidemic locally were huge boosters of traffic, and that's gone now. I think some people even said that of course we had January 6th, and then we've had the Ukraine war, but those are fading as compelling news stories. And that's sort of a related point, which some studies by the Reuters Institute over at Oxford University in England and Pew and some others indicate there are a fair number of people now who practice what's called news avoidance. They are kind of depressed by the news, and they feel like, except for some basic information about weather and traffic and some of what's going on in their locality, they're better off skipping it. So those things have converged to make this a year where, at least as measured by page views, traffic is down maybe 15-20%.
Yeah, I've heard about the news avoidance thing. It makes me start to wonder. I was looking at more numbers. The local news initiative at Medill at Northwestern University reports that some 360 newspapers closed between late 2019 and the end of May.
Yeah.
And it predicts that the country's on track to lose a third more by 2025. And it makes me wonder, I'm going to ask Tim Franklin, senior associate dean at Medill, but I'm curious what you think too. I mean, do people even know what they're missing anymore? When they say news avoidance, do they know what else?
I think, I have to say generally, yes. I mean, I think people know what the news is, the mix of things that's in there. And, you know, you and I and a fair number of news consumers think that's kind of essential to being an informed citizen and knowing what you're looking for when you vote. Not everybody votes. But yeah, I mean, it's a disturbing trend. Tim, by the way, used to be my boss. He was a pointer before he went there. And we have very similar thinking about these things. I mean, I would also say, probably relevant to your listeners, that, you know, yes, this number of papers that have closed is significant. Most of them are smaller, many of them weeklies. And I've been saying to anybody who will listen that this sort of hollowing out of the rest of the papers is at least as significant or more significant. I mean, we're an urban nation, and when hypothetically a paper goes from a staff of 100 that reporters and editors had had some years back to 20, that is a big subtraction of the news production and how well informed people are.
Boots on the ground, so to speak. Let's see, Mark in Clintonville, you're on the air. Hi, Mark.
Hello. I hit a paywall on a news site, and I just go elsewhere.
I can't hear you. I'm sorry.
Is it possible to, or is it too? Is it economically unfeasible to go to like a pay-per-view or pay-per-story model? And I'll listen off the air.
All right. Thank you, Mark. What do you think, Rick Edmonds?
Yeah, I got to say, Mark, that has been tried and tried and tried again, and it doesn't really seem to work as a business. And there are different versions of it sometimes. I just wrote about one of these startups recently that, you know, you can sort of buy a service where you get 30 stories a month or something like that. And that just doesn't really seem the way that that people can want to consume news. So it seems like a very sound idea in theory, and certainly something that those of us who like news and professionally and personally, I like to sample papers all over the country, you know, Chicago Tribune and the Los Angeles Times. But at this point, that's not a business model that's made sense.
You know, I wanted to go to the Tampa Tribune and a lot of Florida papers in the last few days because, for obvious reasons, right? The hurricane. And it made me wonder about the days that smaller papers, regional papers, would win Pulitzers for their coverage of cataclysm and natural disasters. And it was an opportunity for them to show their mettle, right? And I just wonder if those days are coming to an end.
I don't think so. I think that Tampa Bay Times, where I work, and the papers down in Southwest Florida did rise to the occasion. You're right that kind of work is often honored by the Pulitzers. I know there were several prizes connected to the coverage of the California wildfires. Mm-hmm. So that's still a strength. And for all of the difficulties newspapers have had, for instance, in the COVID coverage, I think they did the best work. That was something where they could mobilize and where there was a lot of local variation that was worth covering. And, you know, that gives me hope that for all the difficulties, this is a viable business if it can sort of shift economic models.
And I get your hope, but a lot of that coverage was also provided for free as a public service.
Well, it was. And you mentioned the hurricane. By and large, if you wanted to read those stories, you could, because most papers drop the paywall when there's some element of public safety and, you know, people need to know this. They welcome visitors. It's also a chance to show the occasional visitor what they can do.
Let's see. Tom in Columbus, you're on the air. Hi, Tom.
Hey, how you doing?
Good, thanks.
great. So my comment was this. I think where it sits with the news, but I think there's also a larger shift happening right now. My TV broke about 5 years ago when my son tried to show us how fast his car was, and it spiderwebbed the TV. And I've never gotten it fixed. So I haven't had a television in 5+ years. And I don't plan on getting one. And we listen to music. We have Sonos at the whole house. We listen to you, right, on Sonos, which is great. But I've never been happier and just more fulfilled because I'll go out with people and say, did you hear what Putin did? Or did you hear what blah, blah, blah? And I don't. And so I don't get all worked up about it. And it's just like, no.
Well, let me ask you this, though. We often refer to journalism as the fourth estate. You know, it's kind of a necessary public education is sort of necessary to sustain our democratic republic and inform people so that they can vote and that kind of a thing. What do you think about that part of it?
So, I mean, that part of it, I think you fall into one of two camps, right? And so you fall into a camp of like, you know, we hate Trump, or you fall into a camp of we love Trump, and you kind of go towards those things. For me, I'm true independent, right? I'm a registered Republican because you have to be, but I don't always vote for those guys, right? I vote for the person at the party. And I actually, for my information on politics, I log into the League of Women Voters because they seem to be very unbiased. They just, you know, give me the facts, right? And then that allows me to make better decisions.
Let me just correct you gently. I have never been registered with a political party. You don't have to be registered with a party in Ohio. I've always been an independent myself. So, but you don't register as an independent. You just don't register with a party. Just wanted to correct that.
Can I ask a question then? Because that's really interesting. I did not know that. Can you vote in the primaries if you're not registered with a party?
No, you can't vote in a primary. That's what's It's killed me over the years a few times. But yeah, you can't vote in a primary.
Yes.
Tom, thanks a lot for your call. Rick, I guess, you know, it's hard. I mean, I'm so invested in the business, and obviously you are too, but Tom seems like a really happy guy.
Yeah, well, and I think he sort of fits the news avoidance model to a degree. We haven't really discussed, but the cable networks, Fox, CNN, and MSNBC are real purveyors of sort of partisan talking heads all the time. And I think independent voters, and there are more and more of them, by the way, much independents that recently passed either party as the main choice. You know, they don't want that. Doesn't do much of anything except noise that clutters their lives when they have better things to do. Excuse me.
Rick Edmonds, thanks so much for your time today. I really appreciate it.
I enjoy talking with you, Ann. Thank you.
Rick Edmonds is a media business analyst for the Poynter Institute. He recently wished the nation's newspaper, USA Today, a happy 40th birthday in his column. We'll have a link to that on our website at WOSU.org/allsides. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. The United States is losing newspapers at a rate of 2 per week, leaving a slew of so-called news deserts in their wake. We're talking about whether that matters today. Tim Franklin is a senior associate dean and John M. Mutz chair in local news and director of the Medill Local News Initiative at the Medill School of Journalism at Northwestern University. Tim Franklin, welcome to All Sides.
Hi, Ann. Good to be with you. Good morning.
Are there particular regions of the country that are harder hit than others by this?
Yes, there are. In fact, what we're seeing is almost a tale of two Americas when it comes to local news. And we're seeing large swaths of news deserts. There are now 208 entire counties in the U.S. With no local news source. And there are about 70 million Americans living in counties with either no local news or only one local newspaper, and most of the time those are weeklies. And they're all over the country, but there are particularly large swaths of news deserts in the South and in the Plain States. And in fact, you can almost draw a straight line from Brownsville, Texas, all the way up through the center of the country to the Canadian border. And they're either news deserts or counties with only one local news source.
What do you make of that, the South and the Plain States? Do we understand why?
Well, you know, there are economic disparities that are causing the problem. One of the issues we're seeing right now is that in smaller rural areas, especially, there's just not enough scale to support a local news organization. So there aren't enough digital subscribers. There aren't enough local advertisers, or the advertisers that are there have moved to the tech platforms like Google or Facebook. So generating revenue to support local news in big swaths of the country is a real, real problem.
I asked this of Rick Edmonds from Poynter a few minutes ago, and I'll ask you, you know, the Local News Initiative, it's producing an ongoing report that shows that some 360 newspapers closed between late 2019 and the end of this May. And the report predicts that the country's on track to lose a third more by 2025. What is your sense, or what do we know about, do the people in the South and the Plain States, this swath you talked about, do they even know what they're missing anymore?
That's a great question. You know, I equate this problem to the journalistic equivalent of climate change. It's one of these things that happens over time. There's not a big announcement that says, hey, all of these newspapers have closed, but it happens in different parts of the country on a weekly basis. And so, for a large swath of the country, I don't think they understand the depth of the problem. In fact, the Pew Research Center did a report a couple of years ago, which showed that about three quarters of Americans didn't know that there are financial problems in local news. So, which is, I think, something the industry itself needs to do a better job letting people know about.
Yeah, I just think about, you know, when I came up through the business covering the Sparta Village Council meetings, you know, and writing about drain tiles and this kind of a thing. Now you have people saying they didn't even know that there were changes being made. They don't even know that what their local governments are doing. And they kind of raise the roof when something happens that they don't like. But what else can you do?
Yeah, you know, people will sometimes say to me, okay, the disruption that's happening in local news is the same economic disruption that's happened in other industries. So if a Sears goes out of business in a local community, that's a tragedy too. What's the difference between that and a newspaper going out of business? I empathize with communities that have lost Sears stores, don't get me wrong, but the issue is the newspaper is the social glue of a community. It writes about the fabric, the people, the institutions in a community, but more than that, it also holds institutions accountable. And there's now research that shows that in news desert communities, government spending goes up, government borrowing costs go up, there's more corruption in news desert communities, and there's less civic participation, lower turnout in local elections, and fewer candidates running for public office. So, I mean, there are very tangible consequences to this problem.
Right, and I think it's interesting because I think when it comes to, you know, government spending going up and that kind of a thing, that's not necessarily nefarious versus the corruption and that kind of a thing. It's because they're not getting the feedback from the community either. They're not getting the letters to the editor of people complaining about this and whatnot, right?
Yeah, that conversation that happens through the local news organization ceases. It just stops. But worse than that, Anne, I think what also is happening is that it's feeding this epidemic of misinformation and disinformation that's happening. You know, one of the things I would actually like to study, and there probably needs to be some more research on, is what happens after a county or a community becomes a news desert. And you see, you know, Facebook groups will be formed, and that's great, you know, citizen involvement. But those folks are not trained journalists, you know, who are vetting and fact-checking information, which, you know, even inadvertently leads to the spread of misinformation. And we're also seeing the rise of these so-called pink slime sites. These are websites being created by political PACs and political parties that aren't disclosing their own involvement in these publications that are basically spreading propaganda. We're also seeing companies begin to do this in some news desert communities. So we're seeing sort of some opportunists come in to try to take advantage of the situation.
Right. Recollecting for the potential, you know, viewer or, you know, it, what they think a newspaper still looks like, but,
right.
You know, they you can come up with some pretty fancy things. That kind of brings up my caller, Lisa, in Columbus. You're on the air. Hi, Lisa.
Hi, I was remembering when I was a kid, we had the Citizen Journal in the morning and we had the Columbus Dispatch at night. And I remember how shocked we were when the Columbus, the CJ, stopped publishing.
Yeah.
But getting the newspaper was like getting, you know, a hello, like it's the mail. You're so excited. You'd lay it out on the page. Table, the breakfast table, you turn it page by page, you do the crossword.
You fight
puzzle,
over it.
You fight over it. And I think the frustration has been that, again, it's not a frustration. It's when, say, the hurricane. My brother lives in Sarasota. Just I was watching CNN because they were on it. And the newspapers just can't do that quick thing. But I wanted to recall when the USA Today first came out, how mm-hmm. excited we all were because it was in color. The CJ and the Dispatch, of course, were black and white and not great paper quality. And then you got USA Today, and it was beautiful with all the pie charts
yep.
and all that.
Mm-hmm.
The other thing that I wanted to say was I volunteered for Voice Corps, which is on the Hilltop,
mm-hmm.
and it's a radio broadcast for the blind, and we would read aloud. And so my 9 o'clock charge was to read from the Dispatch, the op-ed section and the,
mm-hmm.
horoscope and whatever. But other people had already done the big news on the hours before me.
Yeah.
So I think there's a audience out there that we kind of forget about that need to hear just good old regular reporting versus the TV stuff.
Right. Lisa, thanks for your call. You know, that good old regular reporting, that's exactly what you're talking about, Tim Franklin. There's just not warm bodies out there, enough warm bodies doing the job.
Yeah, you know, the numbers are imprecise, but it looks like about half of the journalism jobs in the country have been lost in the last decade. And we've seen local newsrooms unfortunately be hollowed out through this cost cutting. And if you're an average news consumer, it's almost like you don't know what you don't know. You don't know what you're missing necessarily from that reporting that goes away. But you know, we're at an inflection point for local news in this country. And you know, I hope that we can figure out a new model to turn this around.
I remember back in the day that we would talk about zoned editions. There's lots of different iterations on that. Inserts from different regions around, like, say, Central Ohio, that kind of a thing. And we said that these things are going to be popular for a long time because this is where people see their kids' picture in the paper. This is where they see who won, you know, which local national merit scholarship finalist was from our school, who graduated, who was in the honor roll, all that, the crime blotter, right? The police blotter thing that everybody goes to.
Mm-hmm.
That's all gone.
Yeah, you know, and that's a great question. And it gets to a central point of this whole crisis. And I used to be the editor of the Baltimore Sun. We had zoned editions practically all over Maryland and mm-hmm. that part of Maryland. And those were supported by local advertisers who wanted to be just in that zone section with the local news. And what's happened is that that advertising has, to a large degree, migrated to Google and Facebook and Amazon, to the other tech platforms. In fact, there are estimates now that about 70% of all the new digital ad revenue goes to those three companies. And so there's not much left for local news organizations to support that type of local news. So, you know, that is, you know, has led to the demise of a lot of these local zoned editions by Metro Papers, and it's also hurting local independent publishers.
What about official notices, public notices from local government, public notices that are supposed to be in the paper of record? What's happening to that whole thing?
Yeah, you know, that's a major source of income for a lot of local news organizations. And it's interesting you raise that. We just did a story about this on the Medill Local News Initiative website a month or so ago. But there's now a movement in some states to shift those legal notices and public notices away from local newspapers. And they're arguing that there's not enough circulation, there aren't enough consumers to see that information, and to move it to government websites. And unfortunately, there also are, you know, reports that they're doing it for partisan reasons, you know, that these are publications that have done investigative reporting that's made them look bad, and now they're trying to remove this source of revenue from a local publication. I hope that's not happening in mass, but it's a real concern.
And the, you know, corporations and philanthropies in particular, you know, Rick Edmonds is at Poynter Institute, which is funded by the nonprofit proceeds from the Tampa Tribune, right? But that's old. That's been around. That's venerable. There are other nonprofit news sites with philanthropy supporting them. How are they doing? What are your hopes for that?
Yeah, you know, I have to say philanthropy and some companies have really stepped up in recent years to try to help fund the startup of local digital news organizations. And that's great. In the report that we just published over the summer, there are now about 550 independent local news sites, digital sites around the country. But the issue, Ann, is that those are not being created nearly fast enough to compensate for the loss of print newspapers around the country, like not even close. So that is the concern. And there are not enough philanthropic dollars to go around to save local news across the country. There just aren't. So we're going to have to figure out another economic model.
And what I'm seeing is that what efforts they are putting out there in that regard are big investigative type of operations, which are very important. But again, we're not getting to that. Where do I see my kid's picture in the, you know, from the football game on Friday night kind of a thing? That's not being addressed. I'm wondering if you're seeing any signs of hope when it comes to local news.
I am. There are some innovative new publications, and there's some interesting new models, including public radio, I might add, around the country. And one of my models for hope is actually near you in Richland, Ohio, with the Richland Source. It's about a 10 or 11 year old local digital news organization that has figured out how to diversify its revenue stream between advertising and member subscribers. They started in-house marketing services to help local businesses advertise online. And they've also adopted a solutions journalism focus on the editorial side. So in other words, to write about potential solutions to problems, not just write about the problems themselves. And they've been growing like crazy in recent years and have been growing revenue. And that really gives me some hope. In fact, we just featured them in a Medill program recently about the good work that they're doing at the Richland Source. There's some other digital news sites that have also, in a very savvy way, have been growing digital subscriptions and reader revenue and other revenue sources. There's the Shawnee Mission Post in suburban Kansas City is doing very well. Of course, the Texas Tribune is often cited as a success story down in Texas, covering state government and state politics there. So, yes, there are signs of hope. There's also a lot of discussion, and I should mention public radio while we're talking about this, Ann. In Chicago in January, Chicago Public Media, WBEZ, acquired the Chicago Sun-Times.
That's right.
Which has been struggling financially for a long time. They raised money, and now they're hiring 60 reporters and journalists in Chicago.
Always lots more to talk about. This isn't my first show on the topic. Will be my last. Tim Franklin, Senior Associate Dean, and John M. Mutz, Chair in Local News at the Medill School of Journalism at Northwestern. Thanks for your time. Thanks to everybody else for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.